Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. And from Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Florida's statewide teachers union is suing the state legislature. Again.
I can't remember a time I've been in the Senate where we have not had one lawsuit or another over education or education funding.
Also this week, a new state law took effect Sunday allowing people to get their mugshots removed from websites that charge a fee for that removal.
We're in a different world where before for a minor crime, it used to be it's filed away in a court somewhere. Now on some of these mugshots sites, it affects your future.
We'll also check out possible priorities for the new leadership of the Florida House and Senate and find out that the best way to prevent wildfires is to beat them to the punch. In other words, fight fire with fire. I'm Tom Flanagan, and welcome to Capitol Report. Florida's statewide teachers union is once again suing the legislature, this time over a new law that could directly impact its membership. Len Hatter reports it's the latest in a line of lawsuits filed over the state's education policies.
The Leon County Classroom Teachers Association is on a mission to boost its membership. Current levels are hovering around 40%. The last time the union got above 50% was about 15 years ago. Scott Mazur heads the union, and he argues the low levels aren't an indication of support. He says there's plenty of it among teachers in Florida's capital city. Instead, he says there's a sense of complacency that seems to have set in about the benefits gained through 40 years of negotiations.
That covers everything from how much someone pays for health care, how much planning time they receive, their teacher evaluation, which now impacts their salary adjustments, and their eligibility for the best and brightest that's out there. So there's so many pieces of that contract that have been advocated for over the years that it's hard for some people to realize the magnitude of the work that's gone into it. And a lot of people just expect it because they don't know the history.
But the bigger problem is pay. Dues to the union are around $750 a year. Teachers get paid once a month. And while the district average is about $42,000 a year, a starting teacher can expect to make around $36,000. 3% of that pay is automatically diverted to a retirement plan. Then there's health insurance, dental, and other costs that come out of those paychecks, not to mention federal taxes. So by the time it's all said and done, a single teacher just starting can expect to take home about $2,200 a month.
Because it is year-round services and advocacy, but there's only 10 payments. And only being once a month in terms of getting paid in Leon County, then that makes it look even greater. But when you work it out to a daily portion, it's a little bit over $2 a day for your union dues.
And costs add up. The average price of a two-bedroom apartment in Tallahassee is near $1,000 a month. Mazur is hoping to get his membership numbers up to 55% by the end of the next school year, because under a new law, local unions that fall below 50% participation of eligible members could get shut down. It requires unions below 50% to go through a process called recertification. Public employees, police, firefighters, and others are exempt. And that's a big problem for the Florida Education Association, or FEA. It's historically challenged the Republican-led legislature's education policies that it views as hostile to teachers and public education. But the FEA has a mixed record of success. The FEA is being represented by attorney Ron Meyer, and he believes the FEA is on solid ground this time. Its lawsuit includes union members and non-members, and collective bargaining rights are also in the state's constitution.
But those rights are being diminished and impaired by this law, and therefore it's unconstitutional. We believe if these people don't have standing, nobody has standing.
I can't remember a time I've been in the Senate where we have not had one lawsuit or another over education or education funding.
Bill Galvano is the incoming Senate president. He says lawsuits against the legislature aren't new and aren't likely to stop once he's leader. And his counterpart, incoming House Speaker Jose Oliva, is a lot more direct.
They must have a specific interest of their own that they're trying to protect. It doesn't surprise me that they're filing a lawsuit. And chances are over the next few years, they're going to have many more reasons to file lawsuits.
Under 20 years of Republican leadership, Florida has steadily been growing alternatives to traditional public schools. Supporters see programs like publicly funded but privately managed charter schools and private school vouchers for low-income students as keys to expanding parental choice. Opponents like the teachers' union view those as diversions of public money to private groups, an effort to privatize public education. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
A new Florida law seeks to make it easier for people to get their mugshots removed from certain websites. As Sasha Cordner reports, it's the only bill from the 2017 legislative session to take effect this month.
If anyone Googles my name, the first image that will appear is my mugshot from my arrest.
Back in 2014, Matt Gaetz represented a portion of North Florida as a state lawmaker. Now he has a much higher profile as a congressman who can also be seen on different Fox News segments. So if you Google his name now, other pictures of him come up first that aren't his mugshot. That wasn't the case a few years ago. Gaetz was arrested in 2008 for driving under the influence and admits he made a mistake.
And I'm of the view that that is part of who I am. I made bad decisions and resulted in arrest, and that is sort of something that we all live with. And I think increasingly we're all living our lives online, particularly this youngest generation going through school now, and the things that occur will be available for the public to see in one form or another.
Gaetz spoke those words during a 2014 hearing of the House Criminal Justice Subcommittee, a committee he chaired. His panel had just heard a bill dealing with the removal of mugshots. But the bipartisan measure died during that legislative session. A similar bill did get through the 2017 legislative session, then sponsored by Republican Senator Greg Stube. Because local law enforcement agencies put mugshots on their websites as a public record, private websites can do the same. Stube wanted to correct that for those not convicted of the crime.
It allows you to send them notice for them to take the pictures down, and if they don't, it's a violation of the Unfair and Deceptive Trade Practices Act.
Some sites charge a fee to take those photos down. Republican Representative Scott Plakin argued that's wrong.
There's a number of websites out there that will display a person's mugshot, even if the person was found not guilty or the charges were dropped. Many of these sites, such as mugshot.com, charge a fee to remove the photo. The bill prohibits an entity that posts such photos from soliciting a fee to remove them, and it requires the entity to remove a photo within 10 days after receiving written request.
The law only applies to those that accept a fee to take down the mugshot. If found in violation, a company could face a fine or lawsuit. The 2017 bill had contained a provision allowing for those found innocent of a crime to expunge their records. It passed in both chambers of the Florida legislature and was sent to the governor for approval. But in a letter, Governor Rick Scott said he would not sign that part into law because a public records exemption bill tied to that provision did not pass the 2017 legislative session. So the new law, with only the mugshot removal provision intact, took effect July 1st. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Florida's 2019 lawmaking session is still 8 months away, but it's not too early to start picking up on some hints as to the priorities the new legislative leadership might have in mind. We get that story from Anne Marie Walser.
During the Sunshine Summit, the Future of Florida panel, Incoming House Speaker Jose Oliva and incoming Senate President Bill Galvano took the stage to express their views on some key Florida issues.
I would really like to see Amendment 8 pass. I think Amendment 8, again, allows for charter schools to exist.
Oliva feels school choice is important, and he's throwing his support behind Amendment 8.
I happen to be in a position where my children can go to a school 20 miles from our home because I can afford it. Why can an inner city family not send their child to a school that the public has already paid for? The dollars are there that should follow that child.
Meanwhile, Galvano wants to see greater improvement at traditional public schools.
I believe in traditional public schools as well. I raise money for public schools in my private life, and that's important to me in my father's name. But at the same time, they have to back away from that institutional view and start looking at the student view. And
Galvano says another priority for him is ensuring safety for all Floridians.
There will be a focus, I believe, on making sure that our security is a priority within the state of Florida, and not just at our ports and at our schools and in our communities, but cybersecurity is a big issue that is on the horizon as well, and this will enhance and protect and keep safe the residents of Florida and impact the quality of life as well.
Meanwhile, Oliva and Galvano both say they're committed to little government involvement in the future of Florida's political sphere.
All my time in the Florida House and my time in the Florida Senate, I have one lesson that is crystal clear. Government is not the answer.
At the end of the day, and I think this, the president-designate said it, sometimes the very best thing we can do, the most effective thing we can do, is just get out of the way.
For Florida Public Radio, I'm Amory Welser.
Still to come on Capitol Report, a brand new online news service opens a Tallahassee office to keep an eye on state government.
How are your tax dollars being spent? What kind of decisions are leaders making? And are the policies serving people?
A Capital City immigration attorney doesn't think the Trump administration will make a court-ordered deadline.
They're not giving us any assurances that they're going to do it, even though they have been ordered to do that.
And in the wake of a controlled fire that tragically got out of control, it turns out those prescribed burns are much more likely to prevent forest fires than start them.
Are we going to have wildfires, or are we going to have prescribed fires on our terms?
Much has been made in recent years about the hard times facing most print and even some broadcast news media. So one day I wandered into the Florida Press Center a few blocks from the state capitol to see what news organizations were left. On the second floor of the once bustling Florida Press Center in Tallahassee, here are some of the names outside now empty offices: Halifax Media, Politico. A few steps further on, we see the Palm Beach Post. Here's the Florida Press, Bay News 9 and News 13, and a Blue Lotus Counseling and Holistic Wellness Center. But down on the center's first floor, there are a few occupied offices. iHeartMedia's Rick Flagg is in one, and right next door, where the First Amendment Foundation used to be, is a brand new tenant, the Florida Phoenix News Service, headed by Julie Hauserman. She used to report state capitol news for the then St. Petersburg Times, Stewart News, and Tallahassee Democrat, but she says she's out of the print game for good.
Because of the internet, it just shifted everything. And so newspapers and the traditional media models, I think they clung to the old model a little bit too long, the distribution model. And, you know, we can see that in hindsight, but maybe they couldn't see it when it was happening.
So Hauserman says the new Florida Phoenix joins a growing group of exclusively online news content providers.
There's excellent journalists here doing daily breaking news all the time. The Associated Press, the News Service of Florida, Florida Politics, Politico. People talk about the hollowing out of the news, but Tallahassee actually, compared to many states, does have quite a few different media outlets covering state government.
Most of those providers, however, charge subscribers to access their content. Hauserman says the Florida Phoenix won't.
We work for a foundation, and our content's all free to subscribers, and it's free of advertising. So the idea is that basically this is a public service that needs to be philanthropically supported.
That supporting organization is the Washington-based New Venture Fund. Its underwriters include such entities as the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. That gives it a bit of an anti-corporate mindset, which is something else that attracted Hauserman to the enterprise, given her own worldview.
So the Florida Phoenix is going to be editorially progressive, and of course I was chosen as the editor because of my progressive background. As in, you know, I've been working on behalf of the environment and social justice causes for many, many years in Florida.
That bench, she insists, will not impact straight news reporting.
I will have that policy, but my reporters will be straight down the line. They're long-term journalists, and they're interested in digging into state government and trying to figure out how are your tax dollars being spent. What kind of decisions are leaders making, and are the policies serving people?
As to who those reporters are?
Well, I'm super excited to be working with my old colleague from the St. Pete Times Bureau, Diane Rado. She's an excellent investigative reporter. I have Mitch Perry, who has been a radio host and worked for FloridaPolitics.com. And I have C.D. Davidson-Hires, and she's a recent Florida State University graduate. And she's a real good writer and a real good reporter so far. She's had bylines in the Tallahassee Democrat and in Tallahassee Magazine.
The service is available at FloridaPhoenix.com, as well as multiple social media platforms. The inaugural edition even includes a guest commentary from St. Pete Tampa Bay Times legend Lucy Morgan. U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar says the government will meet court deadlines to reunite children with their parents after being separated at the southern border. After public outcry, President Trump signed an executive order reversing the policy, saying families will now be detained together. A federal judge in California has ordered the youngest children be reunited by Tuesday and the rest before the end of this month. Neil Rambana is an immigration attorney with the law firm Rambana and Ricci in Tallahassee. He told Florida Public Radio's Gina Jordan he doubts the government will meet those court-ordered deadlines.
What you're seeing is that the Department of Homeland Security, Health and Human Services, they're hiding the numbers. We're not seeing the statistics of whether or not those children are being reunited with their families.
So if they don't hit those deadlines, which it sounds like you think they won't, what's supposed to happen?
I think it will be a situation where they'll sweep the information under the rug and hope that people will not follow up on their egregious behavior of separating these families and creating this incredible turmoil and hardship on these children and their parents. Unfortunately, they are dragging their feet. They're not doing what they're supposed to be doing. The court has ordered that they be together. The executive order says they will do it as best as possible, so they're not giving us any assurances that they're going to do it, even though they have been ordered to do that.
Secretary Azar says officials have identified less than 3,000 children who have potentially been separated from parents, and about 100 of those are under 5 years old. What happens after the families are reunited?
From what we understand, there are a few that are being reunited, but there is this policy that appears that we will reunite you if you agree to be deported. And that seems to be the modus operandi of the government at this point.
We understand that DNA testing is being used to speed up reuniting these families, and the government says that they have more than 230 people working to match children with their parents. How and why did we get to the point where children are being separated from their parents?
We have evolved into a zero-tolerance administration. They have identified that this is the best way to dissuade people who are coming to our border to ask for an immigration benefit, asylum, to dissuade them from making that request. And the trauma of being separated as a parent from your child is so much so that they see that it's working and that these people who rightfully are allowed to ask for asylum are signing off and say, just send me back. I won't even ask for the benefit because what you're doing by ripping my child away from me is too much for us to endure.
Thank you for talking with us today.
I appreciate you. Thank you.
That was Tallahassee immigration attorney Neil Rambana speaking with Florida Public Radio's Gina Jordan. If you don't live near the coast, the fact that the seas are rising may not be among your top 10 concerns. As we hear from Kate Stein at member station WLRN in Miami, Galen Troyer has an explanation for that.
As humans, we do a lot of learning through experience. And the challenge with sea level rise is we have not experienced it. In South Florida, despite a lot of good talk and good planning, there's been limited action to help make the future impacts of sea level rise present for the residents of South Florida. So it's not particularly present in their lives, and they have other issues that are very important. Affordable housing or housing affordability, even for the middle class. Transportation, which does intersect with sea level rise, but it's not obvious that sea level rise is going to make transportation even worse. Those are the things that seem to motivate politicians more, and they motivate residents more.
So tell me about your research.
Kind of working off of that idea that experience is really important for learning and important for motivating people to even learn about sea level rise. We did a study of homeowners in South Florida where we put them online in an online simulation. And you click on the link, and the link says, for the next 20 minutes, imagine that you are yourself, but you're going to be accelerated into the future so that you can experience the impacts of sea level rise. And we had news articles and we had scientific reports that we created.
And these were things that you created as if they were in like future news reports, like a report from 2020 or something.
Yes. And what we found is that the thing that looks like it gets people engaged is a threat to themselves, or a threat to something that really affects their identity. So individuals who care a lot about the environment or about the Everglades are definitely motivated to act on sea level rise. They're some of the most active individuals because they see that the Everglades is only a couple of feet above sea level and that environment will change very soon. And then in our research, for the people who weren't motivated by those kind of external issues, they were motivated by the cost, by making that connection that if they didn't deal with it, or if the society really, if as a society we didn't deal with sea level rise and we continued to invest in vulnerable real estate and build the city in ways that was vulnerable to sea level rise, it would mean higher taxes and it would mean a lower quality of life.
You studied for a while in the Netherlands. How does the thinking on sea level rise there compare to what you're seeing in South Florida?
In the Netherlands, they do not doubt that they need to do something about it. And that comes from their history of flooding and from the fact that they've been able to really control their environment. And that political unity just doesn't exist in South Florida. The other thing that they have is money. They have a dedicated fund, hundreds of euros per individual, that is dedicated to water management. And that means that they have a bunch of money that they can spend. Interestingly, in South Florida, we have a mechanism for doing this in the South Florida Water Management District. It has taxing authority, but there hasn't been a political will to raise rates or to use that taxing mechanism as a way to really invest in the community.
So you work in Connecticut now, but you did live in Miami when you were doing this research on how hard it can be to get people to think about sea level rise or take action on it. Was that experience depressing?
I think working in climate can be depressing, but you have to get over it, honestly. And I think you have to have a sense of humor about it.
That was University of Connecticut sea level rise researcher Galen Troyer speaking with WLRN's Kate Stein. You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, a wildfire caused by a prescribed burn is a rare occurrence. Typically, scientists say controlled burns play a central role in preventing an out-of-control blaze. But as Regan McCarthy reports, officials also admit they're still learning how to manage and understand prescribed fires.
Personnel be advised, there is a test fire down at drop point 4. We now have fire on the ground and the burn experiment's underway.
Kevin Hyers is a wildland fire scientist at Tall Timber Research Station.
We generally recognize now that across the United States, we need more fire, not less. Almost all forested ecosystems, particularly in the southeast or eastern United States, require fire to maintain forest structure, biodiversity, and ecosystem services.
On this day, he's joining a group of fire researchers, managers, regulators, and policymakers to better understand prescribed burns. Those are the fires purposefully set by experts to help maintain habitats that are important to native plants and animals. David Godwin is also part of that group. He's the coordinator for the Southern Fire Exchange and says there's a lot left to learn about prescribed fires.
There's a lot of research currently and historically on wildfires, understanding how wildfires behave and their effects and predicting them and all that sort of thing. But what's really interesting, unique about the group of folks this week is that they're working on trying to understand prescribed fires. And these are the fires that we use.
A prescribed burn in Franklin County is behind a fire that devastated the small North Florida community of East Point. And Hyers is hopeful that fire will be used as a learning opportunity as well. The Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission ordered the prescribed burn. It has since temporarily halted its prescribed burn operation to review its policies. But Godwin points out accidents such as that Franklin County fire are few and far between.
In terms of escaped prescribed fires, it's exceedingly low in terms of the number of successful prescribed fires that we see in Florida. We had some numbers that came in from the Florida Forest Service for 2017, and in that year, they authorized 81,174 prescribed fires across the state. That's a lot of prescribed fires, 81,000. And that's almost 2 million acres of authorized prescribed fires in Florida alone. Of those, less than 1%, 0.1% were escapes.
Godwin says in a state like Florida, fire is inevitable. So he says people have a choice.
Are we going to have wildfires or are we going to have prescribed fires on our terms? And I think pretty much the universal answer is if we're going to have fire one way or another on pretty much most of these pieces of property, let's go ahead and choose to have prescribed fires. So then we can use fire on our terms. We can be conscientious about the smoke and the direction that smoke is going to travel, and we can do it in the safest manner possible. With prescribed fire, we're being proactive. With a wildfire, we're being reactive.
Officials say in addition to protecting important habitats and helping forests grow, prescribed burns also reduce the chance of wildfires and make them easier to control if they do start by burning off fuel that might otherwise be ignited by a lightning strike or wayward campfire. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Ryan Daly, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Anne-Marie Walser. Thanks also to our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And please join us each week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at wfsu.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org. And from Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.